Hello, hello, OdaFest podcast listeners. With me today, the reunion episode, we have Nancy and Jay at the same time.
I survived.
We finally settled if they're the same person.
I survived.
We understood that you couldn't handle us at full power, but we're here anyways.
You know, honestly, I love both of you, but when I get time with both of you separately, it's a lot of fun and it's a different vibe.
It's true. Angelo and I are very different vibes in general.
Yeah.
But like not in bad ways. We're just
surprisingly
different people.
Weird. Like, clearly there's an established pattern that anytime Angelo and I talk together, it is going to be technical. We're going to get into some weird level of detail. It gets funny and it gets funky.
We have to hold ourselves back from getting to like techno babble territories, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of like pushing up of glasses happening, like the mental version of that, you know what I mean?
Actually,
this is how that works. So
I wish techno babble came with more techno.
Well, I've got a turbo encabulator to sell you.
Oh, good.
But yes, welcome back to our lovely little podcast on their tiny, tiny corner of the internet.
And we even have an announcement directly for you. Do you like food? We like food. Om nom 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 nom. Introducing OdaFest's first ever community cookbook. Do you have a real sugoi oishi recipe? Are you a real life senshi? Would you describe your meals as chef's kiss? Come be a part of OdaFest history and submit up to 3 recipes for the cookbook at odafest/cookbook. That is odafe.st/cookbook. Submissions are open until March 15th. We'll try to include all submitted recipes, but no guarantees due to capacity. Sorry, uwu.
I'm going to submit that beef bourguignon that I've been making and see if anybody actually wants that recipe in the book.
Nice.
I mean, I'd take it just on the side.
Oh, I could put in my tamago nagyaki.
There you go.
I have not submitted a recipe, mainly because I do cook in the way of our ancestors, which is mostly...
By vibes?
You eyeball it?
By vibes, absolutely.
Yeah.
By vibes.
And... I really don't. I really, really don't cook by recipe. Even when I'm learning something new, I follow the recipe...
Ish.
Only to a point, yes. Which
yeah,
is why
no, I do, the same
I do
thing.
Not bake, by the way.
Well, okay, that also has worked out for me because I also bake. And for the most part, I'll follow the recipe pretty well the first couple times, and then once I figure out how it works, I stop looking at the recipe.
My level I have no of following the baking, recipe is entirely around how familiar I am with the dish.
Oh.
Like,
that makes sense.
There are times where, even if I'm making something like tamagoyaki, right, I'm going to look up the measurements, because if I don't do it, I might add too much soy sauce, or I might not add enough mirin, or... And a lot of these things... will change how well the egg rolls up.
So eggs are very finicky, yes.
Yeah, getting in the correct ballpark can make a big difference. But on other things, like I was actually cooking something just this morning where it was so close to things that I've done a million times before, where I looked at the recipe, got the vibes, and then went to town.
Nice.
Yeah.
I am actually making beef bourguignon for today.
Oh.
That will be dinner today.
Oh.
Very nice.
We're doing something similar today.
Ooh.
I'm doing some braised short rib.
Yummy.
I'm going to be starting as soon as we're done recording today.
Yeah, me too.
Very nice.
I'm gonna gotta go and do a thing. Get that started. Let it braise.
It's almost like today's some kind of day.
It's almost like we're recording on the day where, like, fifth graders would be passing around little cards with, like, Dragon Ball Z characters on them.
Do you like me? Circle, yes. No, maybe. Definitely not. Okay, maybe again. And yes again.
I don't know. Valentine's, peak Valentine's Day was literally like first to fourth grade. Giving around like little cards and candies at each desk.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, it's like, wow, I'm limiting it to like one person. What the heck?
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, you know, yeah. I no longer have the capacity. I'm no longer the
social battery is only large enough.
You know, I'm no longer the Casanova that I used to be, trying to get around to each member of the classroom. No.
Not going to lie, I feel like Dio would have something to say if I started giving away too many Valentines.
Maybe.
Maybe.
But I don't know, maybe I could just cook my way out of it.
But I also subscribe to, like, being that person who tells their friends that I love them. Like, in a, you know, it is a form of love, so...
Of course.
I don't know. I also like to feed people as a form of love, so maybe that's why this works out so well.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. On this Valentine's Day and every Valentine's Day hereforth, make sure to kiss a homie. Platonically.
Platonically. Remember to ask for consent before you do.
Right on the forehead. Make it sloppy.
Aw.
Ooh, true.
Right on the noggin.
Exactly. But no, ooh. I have been showing my affection today through cooking.
Mm.
The first thing I did, I saw a YouTube short that inspired me. And it is so ridiculously simple. It is literally just making bacon, scrambled eggs, shredding some cheese, rolling it in some rice paper, forming it into the shape of a bagel, and then baking it with bagel seasoning on it.
That sounds amazing.
I don't understand what the point of rolling it into a bagel shape will do for it.
Nothing.
That's arbitrary.
It was a burrito shaped.
Yeah.
It was a complication. Because the YouTube short, the guy making the short was like, yeah, I've always really loved bagels. I always loved, like, New York bagels. But, like, you know, if you eat too many bagels, you know what happens. So I wanted something that was, like, vaguely bagel-shaped to really get that bagel craving taken care of. And let me tell you, it's a lot harder to roll them into the shape of a bagel. Like,
You
make them into a tube, and then you try to, like, form it, and the end just kind of, like, balls up. And if you overstuff it, it doesn't, like, completely close up. The next time I do it, because let me tell you, it was delicious enough that I'm definitely doing it again. The next time I do it, I am just going to leave it roughly in spring roll shape or burrito shape.
Spring roll
it. Whatever you'd like to call it. But no, it actually was fantastic. It was a lot of work, but you know, when you want to make something a little bit nicer for someone, when you want to show someone a little bit of a fancy flair, it's worth it. It's good.
Nice. Yeah. I appreciate that. That's a good idea. I might try that one of these days.
I absolutely recommend it. And yeah, it is just get your rice paper. You can use just water if you want, but you can also do, like, an egg wash to loosen it up. That helped it get real crispy in the oven.
Hmm.
And then after you form it, you just bake it in the oven for, like, 12 minutes at 400. And they were hot. It was, like, I tell you what, it was, like, a hot pocket right out of the microwave. A little bit resembling lava.
Nuclear.
Exactly. Like, just Chernobyl in your mouth. So...
Oof.
Make some coffee,
mm-hmm.
Let it cool down, and it's going to be good.
Love it. That's great. I made milk tea this morning because we had a craving for bubble tea, but not for the bubbles. More just like that craving for the milk tea. So I made a version of it. I had tapioca on hand
because
we made
Hong Kong style?
Yeah. I tried anyway. Of course, it's not going to be quite as good without, like, all the evaporated milk, but it was pretty good.
What is Hong Kong-style milk tea?
I feel like Jay would be able to explain this better, but you effectively boil the tea on the stove, like in the milk.
Okay.
Instead of doing like an English style steep, where you steep the tea leaves in hot water and then you add a cream to it. So,
all right.
So yeah, you kind of do the brewing on the stovetop for a bit. You really like get as much of that tea out of it as possible. In Hong Kong style, if you did it traditionally, there's a mesh bag that you actually do a pull from.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I didn't do it that way. I just I did it the plebeian. I'm doing this at home style, and I had some tapioca left over from when I made mango sago the other day. So I just took those and I put them in the milk tea. It's actually really, really good that way.
Nice.
But because tapioca is not sweetened, it actually takes some of that like over sweetness and over milkiness away. And I liked it. I actually really like this. I would do this again.
That sounds fantastic.
It was great.
Oh, speaking of which, I haven't gone yet. I don't know if they're open yet, but there's like a new Hong Kong street eats place opening up in the Avenida Food Hall. I'm super excited to try it once they do open up. We don't really have too many Hong Kong style
eateries
like
here?
Street food style ones. We have a lot of, I think there's like some Korean ones. Mm-hmm. Mostly they're Korean, I feel like, and some dessert houses we have that are kind of Hong Kong-ish.
Korean street food definitely really took off here for sure.
Yes, but I would love to see a Hong Kong style one. It's opening
that
up soon.
Super cool.
Time for a field trip.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
I'm actually not familiar with Hong Kong street food at all.
Hmm.
Is there anything in particular that you would gas up about it? Like, what is your favorite thing from Hong Kong street food?
There's a lot of definitions of Hong Kong street food technically, because Hong Kong as a city, it's like a city that doesn't cook, in the sense that like not a lot of people do home cooking.
I've heard that it's actually cheaper to eat out than it is to cook at home.
Cheaper, and people really just don't like people will eat out 3 meals a day, including snacks. Like, they'll have breakfast at the little Ta Ta Tang, which is essentially a Hong Kong style cafe that has British influence in it. They'll eat that at a little restaurant that'll probably be underneath their apartment, like in the little strip mall area underneath their apartments. They'll probably go to that for breakfast, and then they'll go out for lunch, and then they'll probably go out again for dinner. And it's very, very common. And then snacks in between.
And then, yeah. And then they'll have late night snacking.
Also true. There's late night snacks.
That.
I wonder, like, that's kind of where I'm curious about exactly what this place will offer. I know, like, the really classic thing would be, like, bubble waffles are very familiar.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, even, like, Hong Kong bakeries can be considered a type of street food. Because you just go in, you pop in, you grab, like, here we kind of grab boxes of stuff, but I think in Hong Kong you would sometimes just grab it to eat there, like in a little cafe, or you would just grab it to go, like just one or two things. But here we kind of tend to grab like
enough
a box of
a
like half
box.
A dozen or something like that.
For example, if you go to a pizzeria here, you're usually ordering an entire pizza, as opposed to like pizza by the slice. I feel like for pizza
kinda,
by the slice, there's very, very few places that do it at all. And if they do, it's only at certain times of the day.
But like the classic things would be, again, like bubble waffles, curry fish balls, siumai, like the siumai that you can get in dim sum.
At dim sum. Yeah, we have like various dim sum bits and bites.
Bolo bao.
Yep. Bakery goods. Lots of nice pineapple buns.
Ooh.
Yeah. Maybe an egg tart. I don't know. I guess
egg tart's
really
definitely
more bakery, but again, you can kind of take it and go. Lots of things are very portable. And I don't know exactly what their menu is going to be. I just saw that on the old Instagram
Let's go find out.
It foretold
it sounds
of
like
their
they
opening.
Can go in a lot of different directions.
Right?
Yes.
So that's definitely interesting.
Mm-hmm. I would also love like a Taiwanese street food vendor one day. Because, like, for example, like the like bao are very Taiwanese street food, and I always love that.
Yeah,
we could talk about food forever. We could just turn this whole podcast into a food podcast.
We did start off with an announcement about like the community cookbook, so I feel like it's very on brand.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean. On one hand, I feel like my tamago nagyaki balls are too seasonal to go into a regular cookbook, but
I don't think so, because anything like that would make for a good, like, carryable lunch. Like, that's something I could bring to work for lunch, and I could heat it up there, and it wouldn't lose that appeal. Like, you know, some foods are really good fresh and very not good heated up as leftovers unless you have a specific way to do it.
Sure, sure.
I feel like that would be okay as like a lunch I could eat, whether at room temp or slightly microwaved.
I mean, my tamago nagyaki would be more like a dessert than a lunch. Just saying.
Yeah, I
know. But they probably would be fine cold. They had a very donut consistency.
Which is I'm getting at. It'd be really good.
Yeah.
I think my limitation would be that I would try not to provide a recipe that's too specialized. Like, it requires either an ingredient that's either difficult or expensive, or that it requires specialized equipment too much. Only because, like, you want things to be like fairly accessible, right? Like, I understand why you might, like, if your best recipe includes, I don't know, like a very uncommon ingredient, it just makes it less appealing.
So first you're going to need a goat head.
Oh, yeah. God.
Now,
you can
grow your own goat head, but store-bought is fine.
But I mean, that's the thing. Tamago nagyaki, you need eggnog, which is usually only available at the end of the year. Or you can make your own if you have like weeks ahead of time. And then you also need a takoyaki pan, which is why I feel like it wouldn't be good. It wouldn't be good in the community cookbook. I'm as proud of that recipe as I am.
I will say for our audience, the egg pan is not too bad of an ask. For our specific audience, well, yeah, I just feel like more people in the weeb community are more likely to have, you know, that particular tool. Pan. Yeah.
That's fair. I think the most complicated tool beef bourguignon would have is like a Dutch oven. Most people have a Dutch oven, right?
If they don't have a Dutch oven, they should get one. At the very least, you can just use a pot.
Yeah, one that's oven safe.
An
like you
oven
gotta
safe pot.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure you can do beef bourguignon on the stovetop as well.
You can.
It's just better in the oven.
It is. Much better in the oven. So, you know, it's something you could do. I'd have to write a lot of like alternate instructions for if you don't have an oven safe, do this. If you don't have this, swap for that.
You could.
Oh, that reminds me.
I could make this super accessible.
Have you seen those absolutely super annoying to the point it's probably just a meme and they're doing it on purpose? There's like the recipe websites, right? Well, there's two problems with recipe websites. First of all, they tell you their whole autobiography before they get to the recipe. But that's
before
that
they
a
get
different
to, yeah.
problem. A meme?
Yes.
I feel like if I were to create a recipe website, I would actually have to write an isekai novel before actually getting to the recipe. So I was resurrected in another world. And after saving their princess, the royal castle fed me this wonderful meal. Now, because of those animals and plants literally not existing in this world, this is my best recreation of it.
Yeah. But the actual... That's funny. because that leads into my actual cringe moment.
Okay.
It's those reviews that people leave on the recipes being like, I substituted 3 pineapples for milk because I can't have lactose and my cake turned out awful. And you're like,
God.
Oh, no.
First of all, I do understand that some people have to make substitutions for recipes. Some are due to dietary preference. Some are due to dietary restrictions or allergies. But to criticize the recipe when they're like, instead of milk, which I would argue is a fairly unique ingredient, they're like, I used 3 eggplants to try and make sure everything still stayed nice and creamy. And I'm like, no.
I mean, in a savory recipe, I could see something like that working.
Yeah, but not for like brownies, my guy.
Not for... I mean, zucchini bread is close to a brownie consistency if it wasn't as fluffy. Mm-hmm. I don't know, zucchini brownies could work.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure someone has made that.
But there's also things like if you are allergic to eggs or if you're out of eggs, you can use applesauce instead because the pectin in applesauce will act as a binder in the same way that eggs will.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've done that before. I've done that. Yeah.
And
there are legitimate replacements. But some, my God, stop.
No. I remember. I can't remember exactly what I was doing, but I was working with a recipe, and while baking, it did require milk. It absolutely required milk. And I go to get the milk in the fridge and it was bad.
Oh, no.
And I was like, I have already wetted the dries. What do I do? What do I do? And I was scanning through my fridge and I was like, butter is made of milk. No.
And butter is not made of milk.
Butter is derived out of milk.
And then I looked. What I landed on was a few cups of vanilla Greek yogurt.
Okay.
And I took that and some water.
That is doable.
As a facsimile of milk.
It's that could work.
It was not as good as it would have been with milk. I'll say that. Probably. It worked. It wasn't right.
Have you heard of I can't believe it's not butter? Now we've got a facsimile of milk.
I can't believe.
God.
Oh, gosh.
But yeah, that is probably my own. Well, not just that. There have been times because the story of Worcester, of Worcestershire sauce, is that it was made to be a facsimile of soy sauce, right?
Yes.
And so there have been times where I've been like, okay, I need soy sauce. I don't have any. What will happen if I use Worcester? It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Anytime
a recipe calls for Worcester, you can use soy sauce. You can't do the reverse.
Mm-hmm. That is a mistake I've made. As a small child, that is a mistake I made. That's not a mistake I'd make again. But Worcester is good on some things.
Oh, yeah. No, it is. It is its own ingredient. It is its own ingredient.
It's really good specifically on those meatballs, those steamed meatballs you can get at dim sum.
Yeah.
Oh, they're so good.
Yeah.
I've never tried that, but I'll take your word for it.
Okay. Ah. Ah. My mouth is starting to become a little bit hungry. Goddamn.
Is your mouth a little bit lonely?
I think it might be a little bit lonely.
Aw. That's too bad. Do you want to talk about something that's not food?
Let's talk about something that I would hate putting in my mouth. Like wax. Wax is awful in your mouth.
You really shouldn't put wax in your mouth. No. Don't munch wax. It's really not good for you.
But your teeth don't have hair. Candle. You don't need to wax your teeth.
But my teeth are enamel, and I want to wax the enamel of my teeth like a nice shiny car.
Shiny teeth, shiny teeth.
I think you're describing getting veneers, and I feel like that's a whole other conversation. But okay.
No.
Okay. Wax,
where
though,
are we
is...
going with this?
Okay, wax, though, speaking of wax, is something I learned how to make candles last week. And while the mechanics of making a candle are pretty straightforward, you melt some wax, you put them in a vessel, and then it solidifies, and you've got a wick in there, and now you have a candle. Like, I know that's how candles are made, but I took a course. Jay and I, like, years ago talked about going to the apothecary because it's really cool
yes.
how much bulk stuff they've got.
Okay. Yes.
I took a class from them last week where they
cool.
taught you how to make candles.
Oh,
and
nice.
There's a lot more, shall we say, candle connoisseur level of knowledge that goes into candle making, obviously, because the same thing kind of happens no matter what thing you get into, right? Sewing
sure.
is the same thing. Sewing is just stitching together some sheets of fabric, right? But it gets so much deeper than that. Go ask any cosplayer.
Exactly.
And they would tell you. So candles, hey, there's so many different types of wax. There's ratios of soy to something else. I ended up making a blend of soy and coconut wax because it's very beginner friendly.
Oh.
It also has a very good absorption rate for fragrance oils, which is why people
oh,
tend to
interesting.
Use it. If you cool. use a wax that has a very low absorption rate, then you basically end up with a whole bunch of fragrance oil sitting on top of the wax once it solidifies, and you don't want that.
Oh, it's like, is it like an emulsification that doesn't work?
Effectively, waxes have, when you melt a wax and it becomes a liquid, all of the wax molecules open up and can close around fragrance oils, and that's what ends up happening when you blend them together and you mix them together.
I see.
What you don't want is bubbles, and bubbles will cause really weird crystallization.
Oh.
Anyway, so there's a whole lot that went into it, and it was my first time learning some of the deeper, finer technical bits of it, like type of wax. Different types of wax have a different absorption rate. How to specifically measure how much fragrance oil you're supposed to use, and how to, you know, reverse that math for figuring out, you know, how many milliliters you need or how much you're going to fill for your vessel. Which is a lot
okay.
of fun. We learned about the different types of wicks. Did you know that there are like a bazillion sizes of wick and how you're supposed to figure out what kind of wick to use in a vessel of this size?
I only know that the only wick that's appropriate for killing Russian gangsters is a John Wick.
Wow.
That is true.
You can't buy one of those.
All I knew is that some wicks were string and other wicks are a piece of wood.
Yeah, see, that's my level
what?
Of understanding
Wait,
of wicks,
wicks
up until
wood?
I took this class.
Yes.
No.
Yeah, there are wooden wicks. There are also like cardboard wicks that are interesting.
Right. So wicks are the ones that Angelo just talked about, the ones that look like string. So those are actually made with braided paper and they're coated in cotton.
Oh, okay.
And
what
they
does
come
that mean,
in lots of different
cotton?
Sizes. There's a cotton braiding around it, and then they coat it in like another additional layer of wax, I think. But anyway, cotton wicks aren't just cotton. There's actually braided paper inside them. And then wooden wicks can come in many different types of wood, depending on what you want. But they're cool because you get like a bit of that crackling. They crackle when they burn.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of math involved in figuring out what size of a wick you need.
Man.
Because if you pick one too small, your candles will tunnel. And if you pick one too big, your candles burn too fast.
Okay. I didn't know that. I actually had no idea about that.
And
really
then there
cool.
was a whole section about how to actually burn candles properly. That's something that I don't think a lot of people think about. I didn't think about that. I just figure, yeah, burn it for a couple hours and then extinguish it. And then the next time I want to burn it again, do that again.
It's not that simple?
No,
mark.
It's not.
I feel like in the mass marketing of candles, they probably make it more simple. That's my my very quick take on it. Like, you know, you buy it, you go to any, I don't know, Bath and Body Works or something. I think the candle's there. They're designed to be consumer foolproof.
At the same time, they're not generally so expensive that if the candle kind of tunnels or fucks up or you get a big lip on one side, it's just a thing candles do. It's not something that you're really worried about. You know what I mean?
And I know on like every candle I've ever purchased, they always say trim the wick to a quarter inch before burning. And I always ignored that instruction. And guess what happens? You get more smoke and soot in the air if you don't trim your wick.
Makes sense.
So I've become a candle snob by way of education over a weekend.
Oh, my God. I see.
So now
Nancy's
I'm a little bit of a snob.
Gatekeeping candles.
I guess. Or at least educating people on how to properly burn candles. Like, if you have a candle you really like, but you don't like the way it smells when you're burning it, chances are you're not burning it properly, or the maker of that candle didn't use a very good fragrance blend.
Ah.
So, you know, things to think about. Also, if you have pets in the house, you want to make sure you're not overburning your candles, because that does introduce particulate matter in the air, right?
Yeah.
Nobody wants smoke and soot in the air. Not when you've got adorable, adorable pets.
All I know is that my mom used to have candles all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever she wasn't looking, I would go and stick my finger into the wax so that I could get like a little wax cap on my finger. And I would just like, I don't know why. It was just fun.
No, this is just code. This is just like a more extreme version of when we were kids and you had like the Elmer's white glue, the liquid white glue, and you put that on your fingers and then you could like make an imprint of your fingerprint.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that.
Candle wax instead. I'd just be sticking my finger in the wax.
Golly.
Nancy's like, stay the hell away from my candles, you fiend.
Listen, I don't do it anymore because I realized, wait a minute, being burned kind of sucks.
Yes, it does. I actually burnt myself on the oven like last week and I'm still waiting for that mark to go away. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Dang, that hurt. And like oven burns don't feel too bad for the first half hour and then they suddenly start hurting a lot more.
I remember there was one time I was taking like a freezer pizza out of the oven and on my forearm, the edge of my forearm hit like the lip of the oven.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
And I
instant
had
regret.
A scar there for 10 years.
Oh yeah. I think I have
instant regret.
So many scars from the kitchen and none of them. I don't really remember which ones are which anymore, but they certainly leave a mark.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Don't love those. Don't love
these.
We're really
giving
people
to take cooking information from us.
By
the way, this
is
where you're supposed to touch the stove and get irreparable nerve damage.
I don't see that in the recipe anywhere.
The suffering makes it taste better.
Oh.
Yes. You taste the emotion.
So now you'll know which recipe was submitted by Angelo.
Yes, you see.
It's the one that tells you to burn yourself.
Some food is cooked with love to make it taste better. Other recipes are cooked with spite to really alter the flavor.
Yes. And my recipes, you'll know because it'll just be like, put some white pepper as much as you like for flavoring.
Apply salt to taste or until your ancestors approve.
Mm-hmm.
Sob at episode 8 of Gurren Lagann and capture those tears to season your dish.
For an extra personal touch.
Do not replace the ham in this recipe with candle wax. Just don't do it. Stop.
Wax is not a good replacement for cheese.
But
despite
the
fact
if
that they
cheese
do similar
knife
things.
Will cut both.
Can we talk about food styling now that you mentioned that, Nancy?
Okay, yes. Let's talk about food styling.
For people who don't know what food styling is, it's literally anytime you see, for example, an advertisement. Maybe it's
A burger.
You know, printed. Yeah, maybe it's like in print.
This is
maybe
what you mean.
It's for like videos of like, you know, yeah, like a hamburger being assembled.
It's the assembled. Burgers that you see on the McDonald's menu as opposed to what you get in real life.
Yeah, exactly. The thing that actually gets photographed is not actual food.
Yeah, no. Food styling is the advertisement version of the food that you're about to get. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is just because it linked the two things we were thinking about, where it's like, why would you use wax as cheese? Well, it's because wax holds its shape and remains shiny and looks really good when you need to take 3 hours worth of photos of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wax cheddar cheese slices that they put on burgers to get them to like just melt perfectly for the photo.
Yes.
It looks good, but that's not how cheese actually behaves.
Yes.
Exactly.
A lot of the times when you see things like, for example, the cheese pull on a slice of pizza, for example, that's probably glue.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Not cheese, just glue.
Yeah, and like, you know how anytime a burger commercial says crisp lettuce, I have seen videos of people making fake lettuce out of wax. What they do is they drizzle it in a specific pattern over a pool of water, and then they shape it. They shape it to look like lettuce, and then when they take it out of the little tub of water, it's just like it looks like lettuce. It does, honest to goodness, look like it's a nice, big, crisp, juicy, crunchy lettuce.
Now,
and it's not.
We're talking about sort of like, you know, your TV advertisements and again, print ads. What I think is really cool, and I think it's still considered a form of food styling,
art.
When you're in Asia, especially, right? Japan.
Oh, I know what you're going to talk about.
Yes.
And they show you go the to visual menus.
Yes, the representation of their like udon bowls or donburi or whatever it might be.
When
tempura,
they have it right at the front of
outside,
the restaurant, right in the menu.
Outside the front
window
or door. Those are so cool. If people don't know what I'm talking about, please just look it up.
There
just
are a few restaurants along that. 17th Avenue. There's like a ramen restaurant that does that, and I think there's one or two others.
Where? I want to see.
I want to say that Taka Ramen does it, but I'm not sure.
I don't know if Taka Ramen does it, but they are, I think they're a chain. I don't know if they're from Japan.
They?
Yeah.
All
I'm
I know
sure
is I really like them. They're good.
They are ramen place. I don't.
Time for another field trip.
All right. But yeah, the food styling in Asia is superb. I love it.
And it's not just like noodle bowls or things like that.
No, they
lot
do it
of,
with
like,
desserts
the crepe
too.
Places will do it.
Yeah,
like,
the
dessert
desserts
places
are
as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
And as a ignorant tourist, I really appreciate it because I can be like, yeah, I want that one. I don't know what any of this menu is. Give me that
kore.
One.
Kore.
Yeah, I can point. I can
Angelo
point and say kore.
Says kore.
Kore
and
onegaishimasu.
Yeah. It's great. It's fantastic. It honestly, the only thing that I'll say about that food styling, those ones that are like a plastic model that are made to last for like 5 to 6 years, the actual food looks better.
Oh, yeah.
In
of
every
course they
single
do.
Way.
Of course they do.
Like, those ones are less about advertisements and more about like for size and
accessibility.
And to show off
yes. That is kind of the nice thing about it, too. It does. I think in Japan, I don't know if they have like a law in the advertising rules about it, but it does usually pretty accurately represent the serving size you're expecting, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the law has to do with the plastic models, but for containers like packaging, it actually they do have a law for that. So like candy or chips or things of that nature, they can't show it as being bigger on the outside of the package than it the product actually is. They can show it smaller, but they can't show it bigger.
In a similar vein, I also learned that they do the same with juices, I think it is.
Yes. There's a specific law about how you're allowed to represent fruit on your packaging depending on the percentage of actual fruit content
really?
In your fruit juice. Yes.
Yes. I would like to look this up to be more clear, because it's actually so unique and interesting.
It's incredibly specific. It's incredibly specific. If you have,
I kind of like that. That's like here in Canada, we've recently come out with a new labeling standard for things that are high in sugar or high in specific fats or things of that nature, where we'll have an explicit label on the package somewhere, usually like right on the front top corner or bottom corner, that's like, this package is high in salt, or this product is high in fats or added sugars.
Well,
and
in...
while I didn't need that to know, it's kind of nice to see it. It's kind of nice to get that warning.
Yeah. And like, okay, so the fruit juice thing.
Yes.
You are absolutely not allowed to display a fruit that's cut open and it is a realistic looking fruit. Like if it's a photo of a fruit that's cut open, you're not allowed to use that on your labeling unless it is 100% fruit juice.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
If it just has like a cartoon or an illustration, then that's probably less than 5% juice. That's like
correct.
It's a hint of juice. It's the La Croix of real fruit ingredient.
So if you're in Japan and you want some juice, look for a package that has a cut open photorealistic fruit on it.
Correct.
Yes. But if it's but there's also some nuance to it. If it's a image of a whole fruit but not sliced, it means that it contains anywhere between 5% to 99%.
Yes. So you can show the outside of a whole fruit.
Yes. So my Pocari Sweat, with its photorealistic sweat that isn't cut open, could be anywhere from 5 to 95% sweat.
99%. So it's 99%
sweat. Okay.
It's a wide range, but 100% fruit juice is very heavily regulated on how the label can look. If it's orange juice and it's a real orange on the front label and the orange is cut open, you can pretty much know that it's 100% orange juice.
That's actually really cool. I didn't even think that they would look at something that, what is the word I want to look for? Intuitive.
Trivial?
You know what I mean?
Is it intuitive?
It's a small thing.
It's a really small thing, but it's like, oh, I want real juice. Give me the one with the real fruit.
Yeah, and you know why certain candies have, you know, certain representations of fruit on their packaging.
Yeah. I will say, however, as the ignorant tourist that I am, that I just go to Japan and try every friggin' drink I can get hands on, regardless.
I don't care if it's actually real fruit. I don't care what it's made of. I don't want to know the percentages. I'm just like, I have never seen that label before in my life. Give it to me.
My favorite grapefruit drink is in Japan. It's called. It comes in an aluminum bottle. Grapefruit? No, it comes in a small blue aluminum bottle. Now that I think about it, I think it only shows a whole fruit, not a cut fruit of grapefruit, but it's called Gokuri. It's my favorite little grapefruit drink.
I love it.
Yeah, you can get it here. It's like $4 a bottle, which is not worth it most of the time.
But sometimes when you're hit with a craving for Gokuri, just go for it.
Yeah. And now I know it's not real fruit.
So
100%.
I wonder if there's some nuance on that law. Because I was thinking, Dio and I, we drank a lot of Strong Zero while we were in Japan. Not gonna lie. Almost every single day, we would end the day by going to a konbini, grabbing like 4 or 5 something or others, and almost always we would have either a grapefruit or a lemon strong zero. They have a photorealistic cut open grapefruit and lemon on those cans, but obviously they're not 100% because there's the 10% alcohol in there. Do you think that law only works for actual juices? Do you think like alcohol or mixed drinks don't deal with that or don't aren't beholden to that?
That's a great question.
I wonder.
I actually have no idea. I think they probably just have to reach a different.
It's probably threshold. That alcohol is just regulated differently.
Yeah,
because you already have to be over a certain age to buy it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And you should be able to tell that something isn't 100% fruit juice.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the assumption that if you're buying alcohol, you already know it's not fruit juice.
You should be knowing that
you
it's alcohol.
Know what it, yeah, I think that's the idea there. I think that's the idea there.
It's a pretty bold assumption for a silly tourist who may not be able to read the more complicated characters on the label.
I say, I point at thing I like.
I remember the first time I bought booze at a konbini in Japan. They were pointing me to the screen, and there was like a question box in Japanese there, and I didn't realize that I had to agree that I was like above the drinking age to buy the thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Dio was the one who actually caught on about what the guy at the konbini was asking.
Oh.
I've never just bought alcohol at a konbini, so...
And now we know.
I don't drink very often. It's so cheap. It's ridiculously cheap.
It turns out my favorite plum liqueur isn't fancy. It's just like it's a regular bottle of Suntory plum liqueur. It's so good, and it was like $10 at 7-Eleven.
There's nothing wrong with that. The fact that it's accessible makes it dangerous.
It makes me sad because I can't even find it here.
It's crazy, isn't it? How it's like just because it's the other side of the world, something that is mundane and normal over there is just different and exotic and, oh, so fancy.
But you know what they don't have over there that we have here? And that
makes next week's episode of the OdaFest podcast?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are the fancy, non-mundane, exotic thing.
Yeah.
To them.
Damn right.
So special. I feel so loved.
Bye-bye.
See you next time.
No more trauma.